Welcome to the Blockchain DNA Podcast. This show brings you the latest in blockchain technology and global developments in business and fintech. Presented by Metaverse DNA.
DNA, the Metaverse Dual Chain Network Architecture.
Hi, I'm Alex Lightman, and welcome to the Lightman Report, enabled by Metaverse DNA. Our topic this week is self-sovereign identity. I hope you find it interesting. So we're going to talk about what it is, what it means, identity management, long-term goals of this, verifiable credentials, decentralized identifiers, key industry initiative, and when self-sovereign identity makes business sense. So the global identity verification market is growing fast. It was about $6 billion in 2019. And before the start of COVID-19, the size was expected to more than double to $12.8 billion by 2024. And the factors influencing this are business, including the cases when it makes sense, which we'll deal with at the end, the growth of the technology and the user demand for it, governance and government, all basically contributing towards this. So sovereign identity is the lifetime portable digital identity of any person, organization, or thing that does not depend on any centralized authority and can't be taken away by one of them. So it typically has six factors. It's an identity model in which any person, organization, or thing fully owns or controls their own data. And it's not governed by centralized authority, and it can't be removed by the identity owner. Identity owners have full control over the data they own your data. Integrity, security, and privacy of the owner's identity are ensured by the system. A central authority isn't required for trust. Identity owners can use their identity data in where they want, for instance, in accessing an online service. And any changes to the data is transparent, and the transparency is sustained by the system. Typically has six parts: an anchor, the authenticity, the agency, the boundary of the self, the sharing of the ZKP, the zero knowledge proof, and then the zero knowledge proof itself. So with the rise of blockchain, identity management systems are switching from traditional web-centric approach or identity federation towards self-sovereign identity paradigm. Self-sovereign identities allow citizens to take control of their data in any time and any online situation. And self-sovereign identity means the full user's control. It's possible to take decentralized identity a step further by giving users control, not just of their identifiers, but also of the data associated with them. That's at the heart of this. And you have this organizational identity management. You see in the, the organizational identity management, you, me, Bob, Alice, others, and governments, surveillance capitalists, and others. So that's basically how it's set up today, so that Facebook can make $18.5 billion in profits, and Google can make tens of billions of dollars in profits from this, and make trillion-dollar valued companies, $700 billion to a trillion-dollar valued companies, based on taking this. Whereas with self-sovereign identity, you have you as the individual in charge, Bob, Alice, and then you give the press certain things, your employer certain things, your healthcare, your grandmother, the police, company X, all these kind of, basically you give them what information you want, and you don't give them what you don't want. Okay, so also identity management methods have evolved over time according to how much privacy preservation they've had. So you have centralized identity management, you have federated, and by the way, you see the privacy is increasing over time. User-centric identity management, self-sovereign, and then self-sovereign with the blockchain. So that's the gold standard. Benefits of cryptography. Blockchain provides an efficient implementation of public key cryptography and hashing that can be extended for digital identity ownership. And it helps ensure integrity and authenticity of identity-based records. You can use it for third-party attestation of records, and it helps facilitating permission based on record sharing with smart contracts. So here's an example of what the flow would be of a blockchain-based identity system that's going to banks and companies and governments, universities showing your credentials. Nurses need credentials. Military people need credentials. Travelers need credentials. This is how it can all work on a blockchain. The long-term goals of self-sovereign identity are decentralization. Eliminate the requirement for centralized authority or single points of failure in identifier management. Give control to both human and non-human entities and give them the power to directly control their digital identifiers without the need to rely on external authorities who can basically just grab that and abuse their power and feed it into an ad tech monetizing machine. Privacy, enable entities to control the disclosure of their information, including minimal, selective, and progressive sharing of attributes or other data. Security, enable sufficient assurance for relying parties to depend on DID documents for their required level of assurance. Proof-based, enable the DID subject to provide cryptographic proof of identifier control and information veracity when interacting with other entities. Other long-term goals are discoverability, or ambient findability. Make it possible for entities to discover DIDs for other entities to learn more about or interact with them. Perhaps you want people to find you. Interoperability. Use interoperability standards so DID infrastructure can make use of existing tools and software libraries designed for interoperability. Portability. Be system and network agnostic and independent and enable entities to use their digital identifiers with any system that supports DIDs and DID methods. Simplicity. Favor a reduced set of simple features in order to make the technology easier to understand, implement, and deploy. And extensibility. When possible, enable extensibility, provided it doesn't hinder the interoperability, the portability, or the simplicity. Verifiable credentials are machine-readable, privacy-respecting, cryptographically secure digital credentials of identity owners. Verifiable credentials support self-sovereign identity, such that the identity owners accumulate credentials into an identity account and use the credentials to prove who they are. Verifiable credentials usually involves a third-party attestation, but it can be self-attested, and the attestation is done by exploiting the concept of digital signatures. The attester or issuer having a DID, it creates a verifiable credential by signing the identity owner's records using its private key, and the credential is cryptographically verified by a verifier using the attester's public key. The verifiers count on the credibility of issuers to trust the credentials. So here's the decentralized identifier we've been talking about. The decentralized identifier, or DID, is an identification mechanism which assigns a standard, cryptographically verifiable, globally unique, and permanent identity to individuals, organizations, and things, which is completely under the identity owner's control and doesn't depend on central authorities. Public key cryptography is used in DID, as each DID contains an asymmetric key pair, a public and an associated private key. The control of a DID is managed through the control of DID's private key. And so these kind of things, there's a little diagram of the digitally enabled, basically DIDs enable digitally signed verifiable claim. So you have an issuer who issues the claim to a holder who presents the claim to a verifier. And you basically have the DID underpinning that. And standard elements of a DID document are DID for self-description, decentralized identifier for self-description, a set of public keys for verification, a set of authentication methods for authentication, a set of service endpoints for interaction, a timestamp for audit history, and a signature for integrity. Those are the six elements. And there are key industry initiatives, including early ecosystems and consortiums that are valuable for helping this. So there's the Decentralized Identity Foundation, DIF, the Hyperledger Indy and the ARIES, and the Sovereign Foundation and the W3C. And then here are the cases when basically self-sovereign identity makes business sense. Verifying assertions is costly and important. Streamlining workflows, missing standardization of data and communication. Credentials are useful in other contexts. Personal data as liability, and where you have a customer-driven workflow. So this has been my Lightman Report on self-sovereign identity. I hope it's useful, and I hope that you one day own all your data and that self-sovereign identity and what you learned here is part of that. Thank you, and I'll see you next week.
Like what you hear so far? Make sure you never miss a show by clicking the subscribe button now. This podcast is made possible by listeners like you. Thank you for your support. Now, back to the show.
I want to welcome all our viewers to the interview on the Lakmer Report on Sovereign Identity. And I'd like to welcome tonight Ken Wong and Alex Lightman to share some light, first of all, guys, on the difference on sovereign identity and digital identity. We hear these phrases a lot. And actually, I would like to start to explain to the community what is actually the difference between sovereign identity and digital identity. Maybe, Ken, you can share some light on this.
Okay, so traditionally, we are still on the traditional world, the digital identity, right? The main idea is all the identity is in centralized database. And then it's usually controlled by secret or password. And there is certain kind of privilege in terms of access to certain applications or service. But the main problem with it is it's centralized for the hacker. The hacker can go just to a single database to get all the data. It happens with the Yahoo, Kmart, with Equifax, all this kind of data leak in the centralized identity. Another main issue with centralized identity is user really don't have the control of the data, how they are used. How can they actually make profit from this data? Because you are the owner of the data. So that's why there's other problem, but this was the main problem. Other problem including you basically have to remember password everywhere, and for you, like your data is fragmented into different database, right? Like you may have your data in Yahoo, you may have data in Google or in Microsoft or in Amazon, but you don't have your single authorized authoritative view of what your data is. So all this leads to Web 3.0. So the key tenets of Web 3.0 is the decentralized identity. The user has the control of their identity. So they may have some of the public identity that they can control, they can review to the other, and they can make profit of it. And then maybe they have some private identity that they don't want to review. But if you really want to other people to use it, you make you have the control of say, hey, which particular piece of data can be shared. And also there is a certain identity has to be certified by third party. Once certified, and you can still use it. Like example, like if I graduated from certain university, that university must certify that actually I was graduated from that university. But then this data belongs to me. And other people, if they really want to know that if I actually graduated from that university, they have to validate with the public key of this issuer. The issuer is the university who can sign this what is called the verifiable claim. They can sign it. Once they sign it, you can verify it because its public keys are available. It can be on-chain. And most importantly, you don't really want to put all the PII data on the blockchain. You only put the proof or the signature or the hash of the signature on the blockchain. So in some way, we are currently moved from traditional digital identity to the decentralized identity. It will unlock lots of economic values from it. That's why a transition from Web 2.0 to Web 3.0 is really the idea of a transition from information technology to to data technology, DT. So we'll talk more about that, but in the high level. It's
Alex, when you hear Ken's explanation about the differences between sovereign identity moving into digital identity, but also the difference between, I would say, things you want the public to know about you, the things you want to hold private. If you then go and look, would you say that sovereign identity is more of a centralized, controlled situation still?
Oh, I wouldn't say that, no. I would say it the whole thing derives, as far as I can tell, from the book The Sovereign Individual by James Dale Davidson and Lord Rees-Mogg in the UK. And they basically say nation states are going to crumble. You're going to get failed states. And so you have to look at yourself as a nation of one. And you have to be ready to move from country to country and have your own credentials with you. So if we look at what's happening in the United States right now, we have a crumbling of the centrally provided credentials. One of those things is that a common insult about Americans is that more than 90% of Americans don't have passports. So it's already something that a minority of people have. We just don't go and see other countries. It's why we're not all that well aware of how the rest of the world works. I've been to 88 countries, but I'm an anomaly. And I have two passports because I'm always having one in for a visa so that I can do that. And that's legal, of course. They're both by the same name. But the United States has not issued any passports since March. So this is an example of a single point of failure that you can't travel without a passport. And the U.S. hasn't been giving those passports for 3 months. And my guess is that this could continue until the election. And so what happens if you're not getting a passport for 6 or 7 months? So the idea of self-sovereign identity is that you are a nation of one and you're responsible for your own credentials. And you provide them, and you provide them, as Ken said, with a hash or on a blockchain or whatever, but you're in charge. Brittany Kaiser, who's one of the whistleblowers from Cambridge Analytica, has talked about own your data. So it's basically owning your data, and within data, perhaps the most singularly important data is your credentials. How do you prove you are you, both in the real world and online? So many people during these riots and protests are saying, show me ID. And it's a big debate around the world. Should you have to have a national ID or not? Should a policeman on the street be able to ask you for identity? And similarly online, how do you know it's you if purchases are being made in your name? How do you know it's you if a bank account is being accessed? So there are people who have had all their crypto stolen or all their fiat stolen or all their medical records stolen and or been stalked because they didn't control their own identity and there was a security breach in a centralized data facility. So if we owned our own data and we had, let's say, 1,000 IPv6 addresses and we only let certain people use certain IPv6 addresses, so you have universal addressable identity with your own credentials, you start to have a system that is not the worst of all possible worlds like we have now, where cybercrime accounts for over 400 billion a year in losses. So this is where crypto meets government in a very serious way, and crypto has a much better answer.
Would you say, Alex, I'm astonished at the fact that you can't get travel documents. I mean, it's a serious economic handicap when you need to go, you know, to
it's
whatever.
It's a disaster for businesses that have to go and get
entrepreneur to fix whatever, you know, you can't travel. And I think on the other hand, if you look at, let me put a very interesting case, okay? Because digital identity is supposed to deliver us the solutions for the future to get rid of the handicaps that we have now. That's basically what we're looking for, you know, more control, more stable, but also reliability. Now, let's suppose for a large part of the world, they're underbanked or non-banked. You're in Africa or Asia or another area of the world that's suffered from various problems. You don't know when you've been born. Your parents have perished or disappeared. You don't have an address. You don't own any assets like a house or an address or whatever. But you still want access to the international financial system. So how do you give people like that an identity? Ken, have you got a vision for that? Because we're talking 3.2 billion people on this planet.
Yeah, so currently the technical infrastructure is still need a little bit of the work in terms of the scalability and the security privacy control.
With DNA, fingerprint, because it has to have a biological connection somehow to prove it's me, you know?
I think it's not just technological, it's also in terms of the policy and also the regulatory perspective, this work. But I would say the technology perspective, we still need to flush out what I call as the ISOPC. The I is the identity itself, S is security, O is Oracle, basically provide some reliable data to the smart contract on chain. And then we need the decent level of performance, and then have to have the cross-chain capability. So that's what is the DNA is working on. I think it's also invited other people to do some innovation on these five pillars of the blockchain. And unfortunately, even you look at some mainstream blockchain, they only like focus one or two of this aspect, not all five aspects of this. So
not
that's
the five pillars. No, I agree. Alex, when you look at this, because this is a fundamental problem that we're struggling with worldwide on all sorts of levels, that we can't secure who's who in the situation that we need to deal with verification or whatever. So what do you see as a future solution for this enormous problem? Because it is a worldwide problem. Anybody who has no access to any economic traffic is, well, basically on the back bench. You know, you can't get access to a world, you know, where there is possibility of, I would say, growth in health and wealth and, you know, basically getting access to what a large part of the world has no access to at the moment. So
if I were asked by the government of Democratic Republic of Congo or Chad or a country that had these issues, what I would do is I would recommend a policy that's based on what the Grameen Bank did in Bangladesh. They got together groups of five or more women who would pool money and buy a cell phone, and then they would rent it out, and they would get microloans that had an extremely high repayment rate. I think that as you set up these kind of groups, that you could basically give an identity that you just say your name for the purpose of the group. And then your credentials say, this person was part of this group, got this loan, paid it back, and then you start from there. I think you start from giving people credit, because then they have a credit score and attach their name, and they have the relationship, and their identity is attested to, and then you can go and make hyperlinks to the other four people or five people in the group, and then you can look at them. And so you basically start where you start from ab nihilo, of nothing. You start out of nothing with a group. I don't think that if you can't get someone into a group where they're all in it and they can verify each other as being in that group and having done this, I don't see a way that you can have it more atomic than that. So I think the atomic unit of trust and identity is five or more people, each of whose identity you can look at. And then as they do more things within that group and within that system, they get more and more levels. So perhaps they take an online course and get a certificate. And you can even learn to read and get a certificate in learning to read. So we have in the mobile phone, we have a pocket college, we have a pocket bank, we have a pocket group, we have a pocket loan syndicate, we have all these things. And then we keep track of them all according to this kind of container. And the container is semi-transparent or semi-permeable. So you can have certain requests for identity go in, you can evaluate them and decide whether you want to show one or more of your credentials within that. And then for other people, I mean, I should have an identity that has nothing to do with the US government. You should have one that has nothing to do with the Netherlands government. And we should be able to have our identity based on how we are and how we are in the world. And it should have things like volunteer hours worked and someone and money donated to charity and number of people helped, you know, things like that. Brock Pierce likes to say that a billionaire is somebody who has positively influenced the lives of a billion people. Hey, if you do that, that should be part of your credentials. That should be right up front.
I think to end it, Ken, if we listen to Alex about, actually, we are not talking proof of work, proof of stake, or delegated proof of stake, or whatever. We're moving towards then proof of, I would say, almost trust. Because if you repay something, apparently you can be trusted to be having a loan. Or how would we substantiate this new item? Because I think it's a key cornerstone of digital identity that somewhere we create trust on this digital identity. So would you say that we go into an era, Ken, of a proof of trust?
So I would say the consensus algorithm and the identity, they work tandem in tandem, right? So the idea of the self-sovereign identity or decentralized identity, this is a foundational piece for the reputation-based economy, what Alex suggests. So if you own your identity, you can build the reputation on top of it. But the one which ensures the integrity of this reputation still is the public chain. It still needs to leverage the consensus algorithm that could be POW, traditionally the Nakamoto consensus algorithm, or could be PBFT, any kind of Byzantine fault tolerance algorithm, or some new consensus algorithm. There's no perfect algorithm yet. It's really based on different use cases, right? But if we have the combined technology of the reputational-based DID and the consensus algorithm based on this DID, that actually open a new area of innovation or research, which could be fueling the public chain as well, as the consortium chain. The permission chain, right? It's more like in the permission chain, you really need the DID or even the traditional digital identity. But in this public chain, you can still have the DID and the consensus algorithm to work with that, to leverage that. You actually have the reputation of the identity that you can actually make your consensus algorithm more optimized, more scalable than POW.
I think to sum it up, because we have to close, this is a subject right. That we definitely are going to talk about together again as a threesome, and maybe Eric will join. We're about to start rollout of the DNA dual chain part, the second part. And over time, obviously, digital identity is going to be a vital point of development in this new technology to get to the point where we reach what we just discussed. So it's for sure not the last time that we have it on the table. For now, I want to thank you both for enlightening the community somewhat more as to what digital identity and sovereign identity actually is, and that we have to do with a new playing field between public, decentralized, private, and public, and how much you want to give to the public as information. And on the other hand, how much trust you want to receive in transactions and other things from the public. So for now, I want to thank you both, Ken Huan. We will see you back again. And Alex, thank you. We're looking forward to the next discussion, because over the next couple of months, digital identity, sovereign identity, and everything around it is going to be a vital topic, because within Metaverse DNA, they see it as one of the key principles of development for the new dual chain. So I want to thank you guys for now and say goodbye. And we have another, very important, 24th of July, we're going to have another cloud conference. And maybe it's a good idea if both of you from a different area have a little say about what actually is the future of digital identity. I want to say thank you for now and see you all next time. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Anamika. Thank you, bye-bye. Ken. Yeah. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, Alex and Nikram. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Thanks for joining us this week on the Blockchain DNA podcast. Make sure to visit our website and follow us on social media at DNA by Metaverse or at MBS DNA. Till next time. Till next time. Till next time.